This is Car Expert.
China, ahead of Germany, well and truly ensconced as our fourth largest trading partner now.
The EQA is genuinely a very, very good car all round. It's just the pricing is off.
I just want to say to the people looking at medium SUVs, for God's sake, stop and go and drive the Passat.
Hello, I'm Mandy Turner, and a big hello to James Wong.
Hi, Mandy.
Hello, William Stopford.
Hello.
I'm really keen to find out what sort of cars you've been driving over the last few weeks, Joe, because your Instagram page has been full of some pretty impressive automobiles.
Yeah, I've gotten a lot of people messaging me about them too. So the week just gone, I was in the Volvo XC90 Recharge, which is the plug-in hybrid. It's my first ever Volvo review of my entire career. So I was pretty excited to, and my first plug-in hybrid review as well. So it was a real learning moment for me to live with an electrified car that requires plugging in. And given I don't have access to a good garage space, learning how to figure a way to lead cables everywhere and all that kind of stuff was a really fun experience, and also just challenging myself to get the maximum electric range out of the battery. So that was a fun one, and I'm really keen to write the review. Got some good photos all over my Instagram, blah, 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 blah. It's all, you've seen it all before. And then this week I'm actually in a really, really cool car, which is the Land Rover Defender, the new one.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, we've got this awesome, awesome spec with like a white roof, the pastely blue paint, and the white steelies. It looks freaking amazing. So I'm really keen to take that on. I probably won't do much off-roading in it because I don't really have the time or the need to do so, but I'll probably do some more touring in it. So like, you know, some long drives, figure out, stuff it up with things, and maybe go to a car meet that's on the weekend that people might be interested in it. I don't know. But some really cool stuff that I'm driving. This will be my first Land Rover review because I've done a Jaguar but not a Land Rover or Range Rover. So Popping a few cherries this last fortnight, I'm pretty happy with myself.
Oh, Will's jaw just dropped to the ground.
Oh, Lord.
If only you could see that.
Don't look at the etymology of that. That's interesting, though, with the Defender, because I imagine a lot of people who are buying them are not actually taking them off-road, and I have just started noticing them absolutely everywhere, and they look fantastic on the road.
It depends on the spec, though, but I see them a lot in Melbourne too. I've driven past quite a few, not realizing how many there are around. So I feel like I'm one of the club, but I've got like the cool retro one, not like the gold one with black wheels and
you need
silly
the
accessories on it. Yeah, I think so. I actually I spied a new three-door one at the where we get our press cars from, and it was in that minty green with the steelies and a white roof, but a three-door. I've got a photo of it on my phone. Yeah, I'll have to send you guys a photo of it because I took a very sneaky peek at the pic at the warehouse. Scott Colley's actually driving one soon for the launch, which I'm really excited to see through the office because I just think it looks so cool. And when they bring the V8 one, like, imagine that.
Oh, my God. So much fun to be had. Now, last week, this was a unfortunate timing. There was a big news item that broke just after we finished last week's podcast, Will. Lexus is saying goodbye to quite a few of its models.
Yeah, so I took a day off for once and I checked the website and I see this massive story drop on my day off. No, so Lexus is actually dropping the IS sedan from Australia, which you'll remember they literally just redesigned or gave a very extensive kind of rebody to. They're dropping the CT hatchback. Well, I'm surprised they didn't do that years ago, so there's no shock there. But they're dropping the RC as well, the RC Coupe. So that actually means that Lexus will now have no F cars in Australia, at least until perhaps some other ones come down the line, because the GSF left last year. And of course, the ISF has been gone for a while. It's just shocking news. So the reason why they have done it is on the back of changes to Australian design rules for side impact collisions. So there's stricter side impact regulations came into force in Japan in 2018, but they actually won't come into effect in Europe until 2022. They came into effect for new vehicles introduced to Australia in 2017, but they'll apply to all passenger cars from later in 2021 and commercial vehicles from November 2022. So the new IS kind of just snuck in there because it wasn't exactly an all new model. It was just more a rebody of the existing vehicle. So this means that Lexus has lost one of its biggest sellers. I mean, the CT and RC are much more niche vehicles. But to lose the IS sedan, which Lexus has been offering in Australia since, 98, 99?
Wow, really?
The late 90s. It's a huge deal. I was a bit disappointed with the new IS, not because of the way it looks, because it looks fabulous on the road, but the interior was largely carryover. The powertrains are carryover. They didn't confirm the V8 model for us that's available in the US. So that was all a series of disappointments. But still, what an absolute shock to lose the third or fourth best-selling car in the segment. I mean, well behind the likes of the C-Class and 3 Series, but still a relatively high-volume luxury offering gone.
Wow. So how many non-SUVs has Lexus got in its lineup now?
LS Sedan, LC Coupe, and ES Sedan. So the ES took a little bit of a break from the Australian market. So if you recall, the ES has always been based on a Toyota Camry, later Toyota Avalon underpinnings. But it took a little bit of a break and then it came back and it kind of sat in like a different track to everything else because you had the IS, GS and LS, which seemed to be directly targeted at your likes of the A4, A6, A8, 357. And then there was the ES, which did really well in the US market because it was a little bit more of a bang for your buck play, a little bit more of a value for money play. But then when they discontinued the GS last year, and that's been discontinued globally, Lexus kind of said, oh, well, you know what? If you want a sedan that size, you've got the ES. There's your option. But now with the discontinuation of the IS, the ES is kind of sort of a quasi indirect replacement for it. They've expanded the ES range this year with a naturally aspirated 2.5 liter four cylinder. Oh, sorry. I just had to stifle a yawn. We don't get the V6 that's available in other markets, which would be vaguely interesting. I mean, don't get me wrong. ES it's a good-looking car, and in terms of the metal you get for your money, it stacks up. But, yeah, to actually lose your sports sedan rival to the 3 Series and the C-Class, that's shocking.
That's a shame. It's going to be interesting to see how its sales will go from this point on. Is that, effective – now?
So from their acts from November 2021.
Okay.
So I've been reaching out to some other manufacturers just to see if this ADR has caught them in a bad position. But so far I'm not getting any word. Wow. So it seems to be kind of unique to Lexus. So it's really unfortunate. Now we've heard rumors that the next IS might move to the new large architecture, rear-wheel drive architecture that Mazda is developing. But those are just rumors at this stage. And, technically, they've just given the IS a big shot in the arm and another lease in life. So I wouldn't expect to see a new generation model for a little while. Now, the IS isn't Lexus's bestseller, even if it is one of its better sellers. That would be the NX SUV. But look to see Lexus's SUVs continue to pick up the slack, just like with Volvo, how the S60 and V60 are just kind of there. And it's really the SUVs doing the heavy lifting. I mean, that's largely where the market is. But if you look over at Mercedes and BMW, C-Class and the 3 Series still do pretty well.
So true. Okay, so that was a little bit of news, but we'll get into this week's biggest news right now. And we may as well just keep rolling, Will. The 2022 BMW 2 Series Coupe has been revealed. Oh, that purple. Oh, it's so pretty.
Oh, Thunder Night Metallic, which has to be one of the most evocative colour names. And BMW is nailing the debut colour game. You had the Isle of Man green with that M3 and that... I can't remember what the M4's debut color was, which was also absolutely stunning. And then you've got this. And I mean, just personally, my first color I bought with my own money was a Phantom Purple BA Falcon XR6. So I have a real soft spot for purple and is one of those really underused colors. But look, enough about the color. It's fabulous. We get that. Yeah. Let's talk about the car. So basically, it will be here before the end of 2021. And while the 2 Series Grand Coupe has moved along with the 1 Series to a front/all-wheel drive platform, the 2 Series Coupe stays rear-wheel drive, except the range will now be headed in Australia, at least until the M2 arrives, by the M240i xDrive. Which has a rear-biased all-wheel drive system, a turbocharged 3-litre inline 6-cylinder engine with 275 kilowatts of power and 500 newton meters of torque. No manual transmission, but a good 8-speed automatic and a 0 to 100 time of 4.3 seconds. Below it will be the 220i. So the range is broadly the same as the current range. So 220i with a turbocharged 2-litre 4-cylinder engine, that's got 135 kilowatts of power and 300 newton meters of torque, 0 to 100 in 7.5 seconds, and a 180 kilowatt 230i will come later. We don't get the 48-volt mild hybrid 220D turbo diesel that will be available in, for example, Europe. The interior looks to be up. Not that the old car's interior was bad, but this looks to be a step up in terms of finish, luxury aesthetics. BMW says the static torsional rigidity is up 12% over its predecessor. It still boasts almost perfect 50-50 weight distribution. It's wider by 64 millimeters, but it's 28 millimeters lower. So the front track's 54 millimeters wider and the rear track's 31 millimeters wider. And it's on a 51 millimeter wheelbase. So blah, blah, blah numbers. The whole point is it looks cooler. It looks longer and lower and meaner. Now, I say it looks cooler, but the number of people I have been reading comments by online, on BMW's Instagram page and all of that, a lot of people don't like the looks, which I think looks fantastic. So what do you guys think about the way it looks?
I do too. The side profile is its best angle. Yeah. But I can't really see much wrong with it. It hasn't got that massive grill like on the other BMW models.
Which, I mean, grew on me eventually, but I'm glad this doesn't happen.
I feel like the grills are too big for the two. Like it's a much smaller car. Yeah. But what do you think, J-Wo?
I hate it.
What? No. What do you hate about it specifically? Detail your reasons.
Yes. Like the lights and the weird edges and the lines are all off. Like I don't understand why BMW keeps on doing this. The proportions are there. I agree with you. The proportion, the silhouette's all there, but all the detailing is just off. I don't know why they're trying to make it. They make all their cars look weird now. Like their previous generation of stuff were like really sleek. The lights blended in with the body. They had really organic light signatures and all that kind of stuff, and this just looks like a Frankenstein of mess. Like that rear, the rear boot lid and everything, the way that the tail lights blend in and the lines are all different shapes and everything, I just can't. It might be a case of when I see it in person, my opinion might change, but just I don't understand how so many manufacturers have these really nice flowing lines on their cars and then they just ruin it with lights that look like they've been cut out by a child doing a cutout activity at primary school. Like, I just don't understand. I don't like it. I love the purple, love the overall silhouette and the shape is the proportions, I guess, are sort of there. Detailing off. They misplaced everything. I hate it.
Wow, the tail lights are certainly probably the biggest departure stylistically from past 1 and 2 series models. But I don't know. I think they look cool. I love the power dome bonnet and the bumper. I find BMW M Sport bumpers can often be just a little too fussy. I find I like BMWs without the M Sport package, but in this case, even with those giant triangular bloody air intakes, I like the way it looks. So, yeah, but you're right, James. I mean, it could be a case of it'll look better in the metal to you.
I think the white one, which is a 220 with the less angular bumpers, it looks a bit better and everything seems to sort of flow into each other a little bit better. It's just with all the cutouts and everything in that purple M Sport, I just find, yeah, no. Hopefully they resolve that with the M2, but I don't know. We'll see how we go.
Wow, interesting. Let us know your thoughts, podcast@carexpert.com.au. Moving on to perhaps a very beautiful car, the Lotus Emira has been revealed, J-Wo. I love this thing.
Yes, and this is one thing I can definitely agree with you on, that I really like the look of it. So Lotus has revealed the Emira, which is its last internal combustion engine car from the iconic British brand. It's going to be using AMG and Toyota power, depending on variant, and it kind of looks like a baby McLaren. So two engines are going to be offered, and this, I guess, is sort of a replacement for the Elise and the Exige, probably more so the Exige because they're going a little bit more upmarket in terms of the cabin and the position and pricing. So the first engine and likely the headline engine will be a 3.5 litre supercharged V6 offered with the choice of a 6-speed manual or automatic. So that's pretty similar to the old Exige engine. And then the other alternative is going to be a 2-litre 4-cylinder turbo from Mercedes-AMG, which from what we can gather is pretty much the engine out of the A45, which it's pretty cool. Yes.
Wow.
So outputs for these engines haven't been confirmed as yet, but Lotus has said that there will be outputs of between 360 and 400 horsepower, which equates to between 270 and 298 kilowatts, and a peak torque figure of 430 newton meters. This is for the 2-liter, by the way. And in that same car, you'll be doing 100 kilometers an hour from standstill in less than 4.5 seconds, and flat out, you'll be doing 290. So it's definitely no slouch, and for an entry-level car, and I say that with the little bunny ear quotation mark thingies that I tend to do on these video calls, but people can't see that because it's a podcast. It's actually quite cool, and obviously, so if you, it's sort of hard to explain without visuals, because a lot of the launch or the reveal of it is obviously very visual. So if you look at the photos on carexpert.com, they've launched in this wonderful blue color with a contrasting black roof, really nice, simple Starspec alloys that look like the, you know, forged alloy units, bright yellow calipers behind it. And then inside, you've got really elegant, simplified approach to the cockpit. You've got a driver's screen, a central infotainment display, and most of the controls and switchgear are centered around the steering wheel. So it's still very much about the driver, which I feel is something that Lotus really prides itself on. And it just looks fantastic. Like, you look at it, it looks like the that new McLaren GT, you know, that 720S-based Grand Tourer one. It looks a lot like that to my eyes, especially at the rear. It's got sort of like the proportions and the shape of that, and I just think it looks awesome.
Gorgeous.
So, in the UK, it's going to start at about the equivalent of $110,000, so relatively affordable. I guess a 718 Cayman competitor in coupe guys. I don't know if they're going to be doing a convertible, but, yeah, I think it looks really cool. And Lotus, I guess, has been given a bit of a shot in the arm now that it's under Geely ownership, to my knowledge. So, you know, it's part of that group with Volvo, Geely, a number of other brands. And so I guess with a lot more money and backing, it can actually churn out cars. Because ever since I was a kid, and I've grown up loving Lotuses from the mid to late 1990s, once the Esprit, which is my favorite Lotus, the Esprit V8 was one of my favorites. They've had all these cars or concepts that they've been teasing for decades and then never actually made it to production because they'd go bankrupt or they'd lose a CEO or their financial backing was lost or whatever. So it's actually really cool that they've got that really cool electric vehicle that's stupidly powerful coming that looks like something out of Tron. And then they've got stuff like this, which is coming. So I think they've got like three or four new models planned, which will sort of serve in each segment. So, and given Lotus is all about the driver, there might actually be a really good rival to something like Porsche, because you think of maybe like a Jaguar F-Type, which is more of a GT and not and a bit heavy and a bit old, and then you see something like this, which is a proper lightweight sports car. I reckon they can shake things up in these performance car segments.
So is Lotus turning EV after this model, or that's the plan, right?
Yeah, from memory, and I can't find the statement here, but this is I think they'll end up doing mostly electric because that new, is it the Evija or whatever it's called, is like going to be like the halo thing, and then they'll sort of trickle it down from there. But who knows, depending on whether they stay owned by Geely for the next 10, 15 years will determine whether they actually have enough money to invest in all that. So I guess time will tell. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And lastly, Will, the 2022 Genesis G80 Sport has been revealed. We're actually talking about some pretty nice cars this week. This is quite lovely.
Yes, it does look really good. Well, James, we'll see if you disagree in a second. But it certainly does resolve one of the regular complaints we hear about Genesis products, in that it gets rid of the two-spoke steering wheel for a more conventional-looking three-spoke one. Now, Genesis actually hasn't revealed any details yet of powertrain, but it has confirmed that the G80 Sport will get rear-wheel steering. It also gets a range of exterior and interior design tweaks. So there's a different front bumper. There's some pretty cool-looking kind of fish scale looking G-Matrix. Now I'm doing the Air Bunnies. G-Matrix alloy wheels measuring 20 inches. You can choose between black and red brake calipers. And inside, there's some different interior colorways, one of which is just this stunning Sevilla red interior. It definitely looks a little bit sportier. Now, this is a Genesis, so it's not going to look like a BMW M2 or anything like that, but it looks a little bit more aggressive. I would be very, very, very excited to get behind the wheel of this just to see how much they fettle with the suspension tuning, because I've driven the G80 in both the 2.5T and the 3.5T, and even with the 3.5T and the adaptive suspension, it's not a sports sedan. It's a little bit kind of cushier, a little bit floatier. So I think that this could stand to be a little bit firmer, a little bit more dynamic. Now, what's interesting is they haven't revealed details of what we'll be powering it, but I wouldn't expect it to offer much more, if any more power, than the G80 3.5T. Now, there was a G80 Sport that was part of the last generation range that didn't come here. It offered a different engine in that it had a twin turbocharged 3.3-litre V6, whereas G80s offered a 3.8-litre naturally aspirated V6 or a 5-litre naturally aspirated V8, except here. We didn't get that. But this time around, there's a twin turbo 3.5 V6 already in the core G80 lineup. So if they do anything under the hood, I imagine it might just be a little bit extra power, a little bit extra torque. And then you've got rear wheel steering and likely a firmer suspension tune. Now, that's not to say that there's the 3.5T is lacking. It's got 279 kilowatts of power and 530 newton meters of torque. So it's already a pretty punchy thing. But yeah, very excited to get behind the wheel of this. Now, what's especially interesting is Genesis in Australia has said, hey, well, look, we'll take anything. If you give it to us, we'll take it, which is, I think, a wonderful attitude to have.
Yeah.
Now, the G80 is a niche player by what is thus far a niche brand, and it's competing in the large luxury sedan segment, which is not a huge high-volume segment in Australia. And yet Genesis has just been offering more and more G80 models. So they started with the 2.5T and the 3.5T. They've brought out a 2.2-litre turbo diesel four-cylinder this year, which should be at Genesis Studios now. They've got an all-electric model called the Electrified G80 that's coming in early 2022, and they have confirmed that the G80 Sport will also be coming here as well in the third quarter of this year. So it's just going to be one of the bigger lineups in this particular segment. And look, I'm happy to see the variety.
Yeah. Ah, me too. What are your thoughts, Joe?
Yeah, James.
I really like it. The red's lovely. I think that new front bumper is well resolved. But like, I feel like with Genesis, because they are very heavily influenced by other brands, I think they know what works and they sort of stick to that. The new G80, even though it's not an Audi or Bentley copy per se, it still has elements of the, you know, of like an AMG bumper or an S or RS bumper. So I think it's really well resolved. And all of their new products I personally quite like. I'll be excited to see how they put this kind of package on the GV80. Having rear wheel steer is a really cool option that not a whole lot of some competitors offer, but not all of them. And I think that the body kit, or if they do one, might make it a little less skinny at the back. I sometimes feel like on the 22-inch rims of the higher grades, the GV80 looks a little bit underbummed. Yeah, so I think that the G80 Sport's a really cool move. As Will said, it's really cool that they're offering so much choice, but I guess as a niche player or also a trailblazer brand or challenger brand, they have to sort of – offer points of difference. And considering they have so much performance in that V6 engine, but not necessarily the sporty look to go with it, this might be an option for people that might be looking at, they can't actually get an E400 anymore or a 540 because you can't get a 540 anymore. So if they can price it pretty well, they might have an alternative to like an M550 where you've got an all-wheel drive, high power sports sedan, and the interiors of these cars are lovely. So there's not much wrong with it. And I haven't driven one yet, but I just know that they're doing kicking goals. Especially I've done a review of the GV80, which I really enjoyed. So
yeah, and look, fingers crossed for a GV80 Sport, because that just leaves it as the only model in the local lineup that doesn't have a sport variant.
Yeah, true that. Click the news link at carexpert.com today if you'd like to know more about those stories. It's that time of the month again when we speak to Mike Costello to find out how the new car sales went for last month, and we'll talk about the first half a little bit later on. Hello, Moko.
Hello, Mandy. How are you?
Very good, thank you. So, big question is, were we up or were we down from this time last year?
Oh, we were very, very, very narrowly up. Because this month last year was actually quite a good month. Of course, a lot of 2020 was just ruined by COVID, but June of 2020 was quite strong. So the relative growth in June of 2021 was not as high as we've seen in previous months, but that doesn't mean it wasn't a good month. So sales hit 110,664 units of new passenger SUV and commercials for the month, which is up only 0.4%. But what's more telling, and we'll touch on this a bit later, is the half-yearly result. Cumulative half-yearly sales are up almost 30% this year compared to last year. So plenty of growth going on, despite those ubiquitous semiconductor-related supply shortages and COVID flare-ups and all sorts of things like that. The private market is really doing the heavy lifting here, growing quite strongly. We saw a bit of a rebound from rental sales as well, and to a lesser degree, business fleets. Government sales not doing so great, but overall, relatively good growth. If we look at the brands, well, we saw Toyota dominate the market as per usual, but Mazda in second was up 30%. So Mazda had an absolute ripper of a month, certainly growing much faster than the overall market average. Ford finished third for June with just under 8,500 sales, but the overwhelming majority of those, about three quarters, were Rangers. So again, the company very reliant on that. Kia in fourth actually outsold Hyundai for the second time this year. The little brother outdid the big brother. So no doubt there'll be some heads being kicked at Hyundai, I reckon, because I don't think they like losing to Kia, even though they claim that they don't mind. Mitsubishi in sixth, Volkswagen seventh, MG getting into that top 10 once again. Sales up 220%. Nissan and Isuzu Ute rounding out the top 10. And some of the other brands a bit lower down the list that grew at a rate of knots were GWM, which is parent company of Haval, up 240%. Another Chinese company in LDV, up 64%. Renault, in its first month under a new distributor, Ateco, was well up by about 50%. Skoda, absolutely flying along this year, as is Jeep. Really good rebound for Jeep, up a further 26% for the month. And then Genesis, fastest growing brand by percentage, up 300%, albeit off a very lowly base indeed. And if you look at the models, well, the top three were pickups. So the Ford Ranger in first, just over 6,000 sales for the month, Toyota Hilux in second, and Isuzu D-Max in third. So clearly, tax time, instant asset write-offs extended for a few years to kind of get us out of the economic doldrums, doing the trick, because pickup trucks, top three selling vehicles, pickups. Next was Mazda CX-5, which took advantage of the Toyota RAV4 stock shortages to climb back into top spot among SUVs. Kia Cerato, now the top-selling passenger car. So it actually outguns the Toyota Corolla on a pretty regular basis now. Clearly, the value equation talks. Rounding up the top 10, Toyota Prado, Toyota RAV4, Hyundai i30, Mitsubishi Triton, and Toyota Corolla. So fairly ubiquitous cars there.
How, I know it's a bit early days to see how Honda is going with the agency-only move, but how did it fare last month?
Yeah, so from July 1, Honda's agency move began. Just to catch up the listeners, the company has basically said, we're going to sell fewer cars, there's going to be a richer spec mix, and we're going to control our entire inventory from go to woe. So dealers no longer wholesale, they just act as handover agents. And the company expects a bit of a sales hit to happen because it's also got fixed prices that come with that. Now, June was the final month of the old model, and clearly they were getting rid of stock. or there was something going on, because it was down 71.5% and finished in 21st position behind Lexus. You know, so we're talking right down in the dumps. I don't expect it will stay in 21st position for long, but if you told somebody 10 years ago that Honda would be getting outsold by Renault and Suzuki and Great Wall, they probably would have laughed at you. But that's exactly what's happening for poor old Honda at the moment. So I think a lot of us are hoping it can find its mojo once again.
So how are hybrid, plug-in hybrid and electric vehicles doing, Moko?
Yeah, good question, Will. So hybrid, just under 6,000 for the month, up 40%, which is not the kind of growth we've been seeing lately, but I suspect supply issues from Toyota, which of course dominates hybrid, play a role there. Now, electric is doing really well. Sales up 200% for the month, and up about that for the year too, incidentally, to 526 units. And that is not including Tesla, which is the dominant player in the market, because Tesla, I'm trying to be nice here, they have a strange corporate approach and they refuse to supply numbers, unlike every other company in the world. So we don't know how many cars Tesla sold. We do know it's the number one player by far in the EV market. So the fact that it's up 200% without Tesla is pretty telling as to finally those products are starting to get legs. Plug-in hybrids, 318 units, up 53%. Not taking off quite as well as EV. I think customers are still a bit confused as around what the hell a FEV actually is. But very low base, big growth percentage-wise, but still a fraction of a percent of the overall market. Just the final one I want to touch on before we move on to the first half of the year is country of origin for June. So Japan is always our biggest source of exports or imports, depending on what way you put it. Thailand in second because of all the pickups that are made there. Korea in third because that's where Hyundai and Kia come from. But China is now ensconced as our fourth biggest trading partner, up 180% for the month. That's MG, GWM, Haval, LDV, but also Volvo and Tesla, which bring cars here out of China. Although, again, those Teslas wouldn't be included in that wrap. But China, ahead of Germany, well and truly ensconced as our fourth largest trading partner now, as far as cars are concerned, which I think is very interesting.
It's incredible. So we'll close the book on June for this time around. Let's talk about the first half of the year, Moko. You just touched on it very briefly in the beginning, but can you give us a bit more detail of how we went?
Yeah. So those 567,468 cars sold over the first half of this calendar year, which is the best performance since 2018. So it didn't just beat 2020's pretty crappy result, which was undermined by COVID, but it also sits ahead of where 2019 was. So the market is definitely rebounding, getting back to that place where we're looking at around 1.1 million sales per year. Things have basically picked up exactly where they left off a few years ago. From that total, just over half were SUVs. And then the other two quarters that are left over were divided up between light commercials and passenger cars pretty evenly. So SUVs far and away the dominant players now. Over the first half of the year, we've seen double-digit growth of between 22% and 39% for basically every major state and territory, with the exception of the ACT and Northern Territory, which are so small that they don't really make a huge difference to the overall piece of puzzle. So the manufacturers that have grown their sales the most by overall volume are Mazda, which is up 21,600 units this year compared to last year. Toyota, up a similar amount, but again, enormous companies with enormous volume. It's unsurprising that they've added a lot of sales. MG, up nearly 14,000 units. Kia, well and truly up by about 11,400 more units this year than the same period last year. And Ford, just over 10,000 more sales this year than last year. If you look at the biggest growers by market share, again, MG has taken its market share from 1.3% this period last year to 3.4% this year, so almost triple growth. Mazda has gone from 8.8% to 10.7% share. Little old Isuzu Ute is now at 3.3% share. GWM Haval has gone from 0.5% market share to 1.3% market share, and then Kia has climbed as well. So they're the five brands that are really, really climbing. Obviously, Holden, the biggest drop-off, but Mercedes, Vans and Jaguar also not having particularly good starts to the year. And then if we go down to that miscellaneous category breakdown again, the top segments for the year, 4x4 Utes, 18% of overall sales were 4x4 Utes alone this year. If you add 4x2s to that, more than one in five of every vehicle sold was a Ute of some variety. The private market is dominating, doing the heavy lifting. Just over half of the total car parks sold this year have been to private buyers, not business fleets, which is great news for the car brands. And then sales by fuel types, electric vehicles, 2,217 units this year, up 190% with Tesla not included. add another 1,440 units of plug-in hybrids to that, and you've got almost 4,000 cars sold this year for the first half that run on electrification at least some of the time. So we are starting to see a bit of growth happening there.
Awesome. If you would like to know more about June VFACT or the first half of the year, the full stories are now at carexpert.com.au. Thank you very much, Mike Costello.
My pleasure.
J-Wo, let's talk about your time behind the wheel of a Mercedes-Benz EV. It's called the EQA. What's the background of the EQA? What's it based off?
So the EQA is Mercedes' new electric vehicle that's, obviously being one of their more compact cars. So originally they showed a concept EQA at some European motor show a few years ago, and it was meant to be an electric A-Class with styling similar to that EQC SUV that they brought out a few years ago. But I think given the global car buying customer base's appetite for SUVs these days, they decided against making it an A-Class and instead made it a GLA. So even though it doesn't quite look exactly like a GLA from the outside with its funny grille and light designs, it's essentially the GLA with an electric drivetrain underneath. So I recently attended the media launch of the EQA 250, which is the first model that's coming to Australia. It's basically a front drive all-electric version of the GLA that's priced more or less about $5,000 more than a GLA 250 with all-wheel drive, the petrol model. And then later this year, they're bringing the EQA 350, which has two electric motors, one on each axle for all-wheel drive. Got a lot more power and performance as well. So, yeah, that's the gist of it, really.
Was this your first experience driving a Benz EV?
Yes, I have had... Yeah, it was really interesting because what I sort of go through in my review, particularly in the driving section, is that the GLA is not my favorite car in the Mercedes range, mainly because it's a bit expensive when you look at its rivals. Most of the higher end models with sports packages run flat tires, and they're just not very refined on the move. So a lot of entry level European stuff, they ride quite firm when they don't have adaptive dampers, or they're quite noisy on anything other than smooth bitumen. So, you know, obviously Germany being the very progressive country that it is, has all the roads are smooth and it's all quiet. But here you get a lot of coarse chip blacktop, you get gravel roads, all of those things. So GLA is not my favorite car, long story short. What I was really surprised about is how refined the EQA is. So I don't know what exactly they've done. I asked the question on the launch, like, have you done anything with extra sound insulation? Have you done anything to make it so quiet? Because one of the first things I noticed, the first car that I drove was on 20-inch wheels, and it didn't matter which surface I was on, it was so, so serene. It felt like a proper Mercedes-Benz. So, like, you know, my idea of a Benz is like really high class, luxury, refined, all that kind of stuff. And I think that some of the compact models have lost that feeling a little bit in the last few years. So it was actually really nice to get in this car, and it felt like an expensive car when you drove it. It rides beautifully on the standard adaptive dampers. It doesn't matter whether you've got the standard 19-inch wheel or the 20s. It almost rides like it's on air suspension if you have it in comfort mode. It was really, really impressive. And even though the outputs of the electric motor don't necessarily stack up against a Tesla Model 3 that's about the same price, you know, I feel like a lot of electric car fans or people that are interested in buying electric cars as their next car just expect everything to have like Tesla ludicrous mode levels of performance. And while that's really cool on a drag strip or maybe in a country where you can exceed 100 kilometers an hour, it really doesn't make sense when you have people driving in, for example, inner city Melbourne, where the speed limit rarely goes over 40 k's an hour. So the way that the EQA has been tuned to be super linear and smooth in its performance, it's very, very quiet and comfortable. It's just a really nice electric car. And it's a very nice car in general, actually. I would, if I had to make the choice between a GLA 250 and the EQA 250, I'd probably spend the extra money on the EQA because it's much more refined and comfortable, in my opinion, than the GLA.
What's the price difference between the two?
So the GLA 250 is just over $70,000 plus on roads. And then the EQA, so I'm getting myself mixed up, the EQA 250 is a smidgen under 77, and that's before options and all that kind of stuff. But the EQA does get adaptive cruise control as standard as part of the driver assistance pack, which is normally optional on the 250 GLA. And it also gets adaptive dampers as standard, which I'm pretty sure is optional as well. So it's got a little bit of extra standard equipment, but you can also option it with an edition one package, which is like $7,000, and it gets you bigger wheels, bronze highlights, a genuine leather trim inside with blue highlights, a few other sort of things that make it look like the cars in the press images. And you can get some of the more luxurious features like ventilated seats and different wood trim inserts and all that kind of stuff that you would expect of a Mercedes-Benz options list. But in terms of any other differences between EQA and GLA in terms of the looks, the way that they've had to package the battery and the electric drivetrain means that the floor's a little bit raised. So in the back seat, knee room and headroom's fine, but because the floor's a bit higher, for someone like me who's quite long-legged, it feels like my knees are being pushed up quite a bit. So it's a little bit less comfortable than a GLA in that respect. And also it means that the boot space is a bit compromised. So it's, off the top of my head, it's like 300 and something liters instead of 400 and something in the GLA. So it's a little bit compromised in that respect. But otherwise, you sit inside it and you'd be hard-pressed to find any real differences between GLA and an EQA if, you know, you're wondering if it's going to feel any different. So other than the drivetrain, you feel like you're in a normal Mercedes. Yeah.
I actually just can't believe the price of that. I was expecting a lot more. Yeah. You're thinking the same thing? Well, yeah.
That Golf is definitely shrinking.
Yeah. It's funny you say that actually, because the EQA has like 140 kilowatts, which isn't a lot. And for pretty much identical money, Volvo's bringing out the XC40 Recharge Pure Electric, which has like 300 kilowatts and 600 or 700 newton meters and can do 100 in like under 5 seconds. So even though the EQA is really good, and this is another thing that I sort of say in the review, is that it's a fun, like on its own in isolation, it's a really nice car. And with respect to the equivalent GLA, it's fairly well priced, but you can get a long range Model 3 for the same money. You can get an XC40 Recharge for the same money, both of which offer much more range. The GLA EQA offers 400Ks of range. The XC40 offers about the same, but obviously has much more performance. And then the Tesla Model 3 long range can do like 500 or 600Ks on a charge. And then it's also about $10,000 more than say like a Hyundai Kona Electric or a Kia Niro Electric, which both again offer more range, but are less money and can be had with some of the government incentives that have been announced recently in some states. So it sort of sits in this weird, like, what value are you getting from it? Because other than being a nice car in isolation, it's hard to justify why you would buy an EQA 250 over any of its competition. And on top of that, the 350, which is going to have more performance and obviously all-wheel drive, is going to be even more expensive again.
So do you think that this is just a car for people who perhaps don't currently have an electric vehicle, but they have a Mercedes and they'd like to go electric?
Yes, in a way. Like, I feel that most of the Mercedes electric models are sort of there for existing customers to ease their way into electrification. At the same time, people might like the look of it, if they want something that's, you know, Teslas have a reputation for bad build quality, for example. The Volvo may not appeal to everyone's looks because it's quite boxy. This is very progressive, very avant-garde. It's got a cool little shape. It's a little bit smaller, so it's a bit more city-friendly. But, yeah, to your original question, well, I think that the main buyer of this car is going to be an existing Mercedes-Benz owner who really identifies with the brand, the history behind it all, and also just sort of feels more comfortable with that Benz experience. But yeah, it's a tough one because I really, really enjoyed the car, and I think fundamentally it's a wonderful little car. It's just when you start doing the numbers and thinking about what rival brands and vehicles offer, it just doesn't quite stack up.
It's like that EQC commercial, the launch commercial with The Weeknd in it. And the kid goes up to him and says, "Oh, wow, you drive electric?" And he's like, "What are you talking about? I drive a Mercedes." So I just feel like this is exactly the kind of car for people who are loyal Mercedes buyers, but they want to make the leap to an electric vehicle. Because, yeah, on paper, it doesn't really look fabulous against some of those rivals.
Yeah, I tend to agree. But at the end, it also is just a very good car. Like, you join the comparison with the GLA again. I don't think the GLA is a particularly great car, but people will buy it because it's a Benz. Or because they, you know, they like the look of it or whatever. The EQA is genuinely a very, very good car all round. It's just the pricing is off.
So, J-Wo, which car expert rating did you give it?
It ended up being an 8 out of 10, which to some people might be like, oh, just everyone going easy on things again. But if you actually look at the scoring breakdown, it's quite there's quite a range of scores. So in things like the value and feature part, I've been quite hard on it. But obviously where it shines in terms of refinement and linear performance, I've scored it quite strongly. So definitely give that a read. The reviews on carexpert.com.au right now with all the scoring and all the opinions. So let us know what you think.
How good are wagons, Tony Crawford?
I love wagons, Mandy. You well know that.
I think we all do at Car Expert, and I love
hotter than normal wagons.
And
hotter than normal wagons are by definition sleeper cars.
They are. So are you talking in terms of like out of the factory hotted up wagons, like a Wolfsburg edition Volkswagen or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. BMW wagons have always been, they've always had hot versions of those, whether they're M cars or,
you Alpinas. Know,
in Europe anyway. Mm, but we are getting that at some stage.
Yeah. I think that'd be nice. So certain wagon you've been driving is the Volkswagen Passat 206 TSI.
Yeah.
How did
Golf,
you enjoy the.
Sorry, R line. So
not, the R line.
Yeah, yeah. Not a full R car.
Okay.
Let's be clear on that.
Right. So the line word's very important.
It is very, very important. But that doesn't mean that this car doesn't lack in performance or grunt, because it does have 206 kilowatts and 350 newton meters. And if you're thinking that's a bit light, think again, because this car will go 0 to 100 in around 5.7. Several mates have told me that in the industry that they've done V-Box trials on that secretly, and they've got 5.7 out of it. So that is a quick car. And you know what? It feels quick behind the wheel too when you give it a boot. What I love about this car is there's not much lag. And as I put in my review, there has been lag on some Volkswagen product. Particularly the 2-litre turbo fours, this car doesn't seem to have it. And I love that. And, of course, you've got 4Motion in the Passat 206. You have some front-wheel drive versions, but in the 206 and the 162, you get 4Motion. And it puts the power down very, very nicely, and there's no wheel spin, nothing. These cars perform tremendously in the rain, by the way. I didn't get a chance to do that this time, but I have driven 4Motion cars in the past in the rain, and you can boot it in torrential rain and there is 0 millimeter of wheel spin, which I put down as being, you know, a very big safety feature for families particularly. This car just looks good. This car sits 15 mil lower than a standard Passat. And in Lapis Blue, I think that's how you pronounce it, I'm not sure, kill me later. Lapis Blue with graphite wheels. This car just looks a pretty picture. And if everyone goes onto my Instagram site, and I believe a Car Expert does have it up as well, you can see the side profile shot outside my favorite cafe this morning. And it looks the business. And for 63 grand, a bit over 63 grand plus on roads, you know, I just can't think, you know, if you're looking at a medium SUV, for God's sake, stop. Don't go and drive the medium SUV and spend, if you want to buy a Mercedes, as J-Wo seems to be stuck on Mercedes at the moment, the cheapest GLE, which has less space behind its rear seats, that second row than this car, has 20 litres of storage space less versus a 650 for the Passat versus 630 for the Benz. And that Benz will cost you 105,000 plus on road. This, 63.7 plus on road. So go figure.
Yeah.
You get a quicker car, Certainly, I was very surprised by the way this handles, by the way. It's got adaptive suspension, and there is a very, very good breadth of difference between comfort and sport, and you've got normal in between. But certainly the comfort isn't that bad in terms of handling as well. It'll still tuck into a corner. But I tell you what, the ride compliance over really shitty roads and bumps and big bumps is excellent. And then not only that, I immediately did a lot of trials in this car over the last 2 days. And I then put it in sport, went down the same road, same piece of road, same bumps. And yes, it stiffened up dramatically, certainly noticeably, but it's still a very, very good level of compliance that cushions those bumps and doesn't have any thumping like you do get on some Euro brands when you engage the sport setting for the adaptive dampers. And this car seems to have it all in the bag. So whatever the Volkswagen engineers have done, the chassis engineers have done, they've done an unbelievable job, really, to be able to punt into a corner, downhill, I might add. And again, I didn't find any understeer. There was very, very little hints of understeer. I couldn't find any at the legal speeds, and I did push quite hard in a downhill left-right-hander. And I was pleasantly surprised, and the car felt really sharp. And again, I go back to the fact $63,000 for a performance wagon with that much space. And I talk about kit. JWO, I'm sure, edited this and saw the level of kit that you get in this car. It is encyclopedic in terms of the number of features you get in this vehicle. And then we haven't even got to the IQ, which is the safety pack that you get in a lot of high spec Volkswagens. And it's just endless. I mean, there's nothing I could think of that you would want or add to this car in terms of its standard equipment list. And I know we're talking the top of the tree here in Passat land, but everything, I mean, you know, whatever you want to name, it's got, essentially, from sports Nappa leather seats that really, really hold you in but don't feel like they're constraining you. And, of course, everything is electronic, 14-way electric adjustment. You've got all the latest tech, although when I say the latest tech, doesn't quite have the Golf, the Mark 8, you know, the little tiny shifter, the fly-by-wire. We still get a gated shifter. But, again, as I said in my review, I'm quite happy with a proper shifter that I can bang into a sport mode from the original drive mode. I can bang it down one notch and I go into sport, which alters the tempo of the engine. And also you get a slightly modified engine sound, if you like. But however, talking about engine sound, I still say that there's not enough of it in this engine for 206 kilowatts and 350. I'd like to hear a bit more of that raughtiness that you sometimes get in a Turbo 4. It's not in this car, and I suspect it's probably the fact that this is a luxury car as well as a performance car, and, you know, a lot of people may not like that. So I get it, you know, it's just that I'd like to have a little button maybe that I could turn up the engine noise. But again, this isn't a full-strength R car. It's an R-line vehicle. And I did have a chat with the chap from Volkswagen this morning, and I did say that I suspect this car with a four-motion chassis and the way it's set up chassis-wise and suspension-wise could handle a fair bit more poke than it delivers. So will we see – is there a chance of seeing a more potent Passat? I don't know. Maybe in the future there is, but maybe JWO wants to answer that. He looks like he's frothing at the bit there.
Well, I guess I can potentially answer that and ask you another question. Volkswagen does offer the Arteon R, which is essentially a Passat wagon in Shooting Brake Guys overseas, but we're not getting it yet, and they haven't revealed the Passat version. So my question to you was going to be, Krolf, obviously we've got the Mark 7.5 running out now, but Volkswagen's just revealed a new Golf R wagon, which should probably be priced around the same as this Passat. Now, given what you've said just now and in your review, which I read very closely, you've spent some time driving it as a daily, you've done a bit more dynamic stuff with it. Do you feel that there's what would a buyer get better out of, say, like a Golf R wagon, which is a little bit smaller, a little bit more, a little bit sharper, but likely similar money with a little bit more power, versus the Passat, which, as you've described, is quite a good and capable all-rounder?
Well, I'm probably not going to get my 29-inch specialized MTB bike in the Golf R wagon, but I will certainly get it in my Passat with my 650 litres, which grows to 17, almost 1,800 litres. Not going to get that in the Golf R wagon, but I guess what you will get is an even more sharper handling car that will be quite a bit more potent and will probably get down to the low fours, I would say, potentially, or mid to low fours in terms of 0 to 100 performance.
Yeah, I think the official claim for Europe is 4.7, which or 4.8, which is pretty quick.
Not bad. Well, 4.7, I can tell you right now, was the old 0 to 100 figure of the Aston Martin Vantage, the previous generation. So it was a quick car back in when we started the old website.
It was a simpler
2007, time. 2008. So 2007, how times have changed, right? When we can have a family vehicle that measures 4.773 meters long, that'll do 0 to 100 in 5.7 and carry a shed ton of kit in the back. and again, I just want to say to the people looking at medium SUVs, for God's sake, stop and go and drive the Passat 206 TSI R-Line, and you are going to be unbelievably impressed, and you're going to leave that SUV behind because they're cumbersome, they're heavy, they use more fuel, and they're a waste of money, quite frankly.
Look, you've got to give the Germans credit, especially Volkswagen, for keeping wagons alive, because not only do we have this Passat 206 TSI R-Line, which there isn't actually a corresponding sedan 206 TSI R-Line in the Australian market, but Volkswagen's also bringing the Arteon Shooting Brake here with the same powertrain as well. So you'll have two wagons of a similar size at a pretty similar price point. Yeah. There's just so many options.
Don't forget the Skoda Superb either. Yeah, they've got the same thing.
He beat me to the punch. He stole my thunder. curse that man. Believe it or not, you're only saving about $1,400 going with the Skoda Superb 206. That's all. Which is quite, you know, is that, I don't know, like you sort of beg to ask, why have the Skoda there at all if it's only $1,400? And you'd probably have to go with Volkswagen for the residual values alone, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but the Skoda's a little bit larger. It's got a longer wheelbase, and I think it's even slightly bigger in the boot. So it's sort of like two different versions. You can have the slightly more dynamic Passat that also has the badge, or you can get the Skoda, which is a bit more practical. And then the Arteon Shooting Brake with the same engine will maybe offer a more stylistic take on that formula and be sort of like a, you know, what with that old Mercedes CLS Shooting Brake that was such a wonderful form is sort of like what I think of when I see that Arteon. So you'll have, you know, three choices within the same brand group. With the same engine, different takes on the same formula. It's amazing that you can still have so much choice in, as Will said, a dying segment.
And you know, can I ask you guys, would you seriously not ask people to look at these wagons rather than go SUV shopping?
Everyone's default choice nowadays is just SUV. People just go, oh, I want to get a new car. Oh, I'm just going to get an SUV. And that's not just older people. It's young families who find it easier to put child seats in there. It's just young people who are getting their first new car. It's just kind of become the default choice there.
There's more choice too.
Yeah, exactly. And look, Volkswagen offers plenty of mid-size SUV options as well. So look, we can shout until we're blue in the face that a wagon is a better buy because it's going to be a little bit more dynamic. It's often going to be cheaper, but it's a losing battle because there's a lot of people who just won't listen.
It rides better, and it has more space behind the rear seat. And surely one of the major reasons you buy an SUV is space. Surely. Otherwise, the only thing the SUV's got going for it is its high ride height. But, you know, you still get four motion and all-wheel drive with Passat four motion. So, I mean, the positives for the old SUV, they're starting to look thin. And I think if people actually, you know, made the effort to go and test drive one of these cars, they would probably see the light and start thinking the way I'm thinking now that, You know, we've got an SUV. You know, our family SUV is an XC40 Volvo, but I'm telling you now, it's the last SUV this family buys. I'm over it. I'm over it, and it's either going to be a wagon like the Passat, or a Golf R, even Golf R wagon, the new Mark 8, or it's going to be an EV of some sort.
All right, so Mr. Anti-SUV, how do you feel about those wagons like the Passat Alltrack that kind of split the difference between an SUV and a wagon?
I probably wouldn't get the Alltrack because I've got four motion. Unless you're going down a dirt road or you're visiting the ski fields every 5 seconds, there's no point to the Alltrack for me. I think you've got to be going down a fire trail to get to your weekend down at Kangaroo Valley or wherever you guys go in Victoria, down to where Marek lives. That's in the sticks, isn't it? Geelong. I don't know. It's a country. He might have a country estate down there where he keeps all those pile of Aussie scrap metal that he calls V8s.
Oh my God! Okay, you're going to offend half of Melbourne. But before we finish up on this topic, yes. I just wanted to quickly touch on that SUV versus wagon debate. I have the same issue with my friends and family trying to convince them to get a hatchback or a wagon over the equivalent SUV. The one thing I will say though is that as someone who's grown up with parents switching from passenger car to SUV, the equivalent SUV will always be a little bit wider than the equivalent passenger car, which helps with child seats. Or if you have to have three in the back, the SUV is usually wider, and that, from what I've discovered over the last few years as a motoring journalist, is that for families that might have two kid seats and then another child that has to sit in the middle or, you know, whatever configuration they have to do it, and a small SUV is usually a little bit wider than a small passenger car or in each segment, so then you can actually fit three people across the back much better.
But J-Wo, that's not the case with the Passat, my dear fellow. It's nice. 18 plus wide. It's a big, wide car with a lovely, large, wide aperture to get all those boxes in and to get your bikes in and all that. And, it's, of course, it's auto tailgate. It's got the lot, J-Wo. I implore you.
The middle seats with the flatter floor is another thing. In the Passat, you'll have a massive transmission tunnel.
There is at that, but when they go electric, we won't have to worry about that.
No, don't say that.
Oh, we better wrap this up. Croft, I love talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Yeah.
That's a wrap for this week's podcast. Where's the car expert team off to for the next week, J-Wo?
Well, there's not really a lot going on because Sydney's still in lockdown and the rest of the country is still coming out of lockdown. So there aren't actually a lot of in-person events scheduled in at the moment. But we've got a couple of virtual events. So, Will, I believe you're attending the Jaguar Land Rover business update next week. Mm-hmm. And there'll also be a virtual presentation for the all-new Isuzu MU-X, which is a huge deal in that segment because it's a very popular car and this generational overhaul is quite significant for that model. There's also a Drive Against Depression Drive Day in Melbourne Sunday the 18th of July, which I will be attending as the charity ambassador. So if anyone in Melbourne is interested in coming and joining us, we're heading out west this time, which is a little bit different. Go to the Drive Against Depression website and register your interest.
Cool. And what cars have we got coming up over the next week, Will?
So Melbourne's got some interesting stuff. BMW 840i convertible, Range Rover Autobiography D350. Oh, you fancy, huh?
Fancy.
There's an Alfa Romeo Giulia Quadrifoglio, which I'm very, very, very jealous. But also a Mitsubishi Eclipse Cross LS and a SsangYong Rexton Ultimate, which might be one of the best cars that nobody is buying. In Sydney, Mazda CX-3, which is a car that everyone is buying, maybe not one of the best cars. And we've had a couple of Mazda MX-30s up here in Brisbane. We've already got reviews live on the site, but I just want to spend some time behind the wheel. So I've been driving the mild hybrid version a little bit. I still think it's pointless. I'm currently in a base model Hyundai Santa Fe V6, which has a lot of power, and I'll be going into a base model Hyundai Venue next week, which doesn't have a lot of power, but not really a bad thing for what it is. So that's what we're driving around the country.
Awesome stuff. William Stopford and James Wong, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mandy.